Hello, and welcome to this podcast exploring innovative therapies for triple-negative breast cancer. In this episode, featuring excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, Matthew Goetz, and Hope Rugo discuss the latest developments in using antibody-drug conjugates, ADCs, targeting TROP2 as a treatment approach. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences, Incorporated. We begin with an overview of today's topic from Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy.
Like I said, I'm going to very quickly go through level setting data on TROP2 as a therapeutic target in TNBC. And mostly we're here to hear from Hope and Matt about their cases. So as we know, TNBC remains a huge unmet need. We have a lot of recurrences in the first 3 years after diagnosis, particularly brain and lung. And we know that in the metastatic setting over on the right, that triple negative has the worst median survival, just about a year or so. Unfortunately, we have a enrichment of TNBC in non-Hispanic black patients. You see that 22.8 cases per 100,000, which is a double or even triple those of other, you know, Asian, white, Hispanic, et cetera. And you can see in the bottom right that with regard to TNBC, non-Hispanic black women have a 12% higher five-year mortality rate than non-Hispanic white women, even when age and clinical factors are adjusted. So high enrichment for TNBC and a worse outcome are black patients, which we're used to seeing. Now, before we had ASCENT-04, we had this algorithm for metastatic TNBC. We have to know germline BRCA, and we got to know PD-L1 status. And if PD-L1's positive and BRCA's negative, we start with pembro chemo, and then we go on to SG. We may use T-DXd down the road, then chemo. If we've got positive for both, we generally start with pembro chemo because of the survival advantage with KEYNOTE-355. Then we go on to the PARP inhibitor, then to SG T-DXd. If BRCA is positive, then we go PARP or platinum-based agent, then SG T-DXd. And then if neither are positive, it's chemotherapy, then SG, then T-DXd, if HER2 low. But ASCENT-04 in our first-line PD-L1 positive is practice-changing data, and it's for our PD-L1 positive population, regardless of the germline BRCA status. I am fascinated by this paper. If you want to have an interesting science read, take a look at this JCO paper, because it turns out that TROP2 does not just sit there to anchor our antibodies that come along and bring their payload with them. It turns out that these proteases are releasing the extracellular domain and releasing the intracellular domain, and the intracellular domain hooks up with beta-catenin, and they go into the nucleus, and then they lead to the transcription of all these bad things, cyclin D1, c-MYC, that drive growth and invasive biology. Super, super interesting. This is a very, very active pathway in triple-negative breast cancer, in cancer in general. It's not just breast cancer. So this is a bad prognostic pathway for patients to have. So it's really good that we have three antibodies to target TROP2, and they're all hooked up to a topoisomerase 1 agent. The payloads are different. They're SN38, DXD, and a belotecan, tirimotecan agent. And two of them are sacituzumab, the sac-TMT, one's with govitecan, SG, and one's with the trimotecan, that's sac-TMT, and then datopotamab also targets TROP2, but of course it's got the deruxtecan payload, and these are all cleavable linkers, they're all membrane permeable. There's a lot of similarities between these agents, but it's so interesting that their toxicities are really very different, as we will see. We know the ASCENT data so well. SG really substantially improved both PFS and OS in our heavily pretreated metastatic TNBC patients. It really changed practice. We've seen in the preoperative setting, putting SG together with pembrolizumab in the NeoStar trial, that about 32%, 33% of patients had a path CR. It was just four cycles of the SG plus a pembro, and it worked equally well in triple negative, as well as the ER low, the 10% or less ER positive patients. That's just four cycles. And with regard to putting these two agents together, safety-wise, it was safe. There really wasn't any untoward, unexpected toxicities. You've got your SG toxicities. You have your pembrolizumab toxicities. But there wasn't a lot overlapping there that we saw a lot more IO-related toxicities because we were bringing in a powerful payload. Now, TROP2 is also interesting. It's part, as you see on the left there, of these tight junctions with claudin. And so they're very, very tight, and they're keeping the cancer cells really tight. And it's impeding immune infiltration into the cancer. And preclinically, if you knock out TROP2 or you block it, then you these cells open up between them, and you can get the immune cells to actually penetrate into the cancer. Very, very fascinating once again. So it makes a lot of sense to put the TROP2 ADCs together with immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we see the incredibly effective combination of Dato-Durva over on the left in the Begonia trial, and regardless of PD-L1 status, actually, this is in the first line, response rate 79%, and median PFS of almost 14 months. The sac-TMT plus Pembro in the first line setting, we can see it over there in cervical cancer, as we see about a 60% response rate. So very, very effective. So it made a lot of sense then to bring SG and Pembro versus chemo and Pembro into that first line setting in the PD-L1 positive population, CPS 10 or greater by the 2-2-C3 assay, with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. We've seen these data, an impressive improvement in PFS from 7.8 to 11.2 months with a hazard of 0.65, highly significant. So regardless of the chemo with Pembro, our standard KEYNOTE-355, we now have improvement in PFS that's better with SG plus a Pembro in this first line setting. And it's regardless of which subset we're going to look at here, and regardless of which chemotherapy, it beat both of the chemotherapies. There's a trend towards survival, but it's very early yet. We're going to have to wait for longer follow-up here. And then with regard to duration of response over on the right, you can see with SG Pembro, 16 months versus 9 months with chemo Pembro. So we're finally getting a little bit more traction with regard to durability, which is a big problem for our patients. Now, with regard to toxicities and the question we were asked, we can see more nausea and more diarrhea with the combination of the SG Pembro compared to the chemotherapy. And that's particularly true with the diarrhea here. Down the bottom, however, there's less thrombocytopenia and less peripheral neuropathy with the SG Pembro combination. So some toxicities a little bit more, some toxicities a little bit less. But overall, not dramatic differences, I would say, between them. And I was happy to see we're not seeing a lot more in the way of immune-related adverse events, bringing in this very potent payload together with the SG. So as we have said, the first line, ASCENT-03 for the PD-L1 negative SG versus chemotherapy, it's a positive trial. We simply await to see the data. We have SASE-IO is going on, which is very interesting. It's in the PD-L1 negative population. So it's SG Pembro versus SG. I think it's a really good question. It's both for TNBC and HR positive low. So this is very, very interesting. And then we have ASCENT-05 going on, and this is for patients who have residual disease post their preoperative therapy. And so that's SG Pembro versus capecitabine Pembro, essentially. And the SASHA trial, which is also for HER2 negative, so it's both HR positive and triple negative residual disease post preoperative chemotherapy, and they're randomized to SG versus treatment physician's choice. So we await the results of bringing SASE into these two residual disease populations. So datopotamab, very similar. It's got the deruxtecan payload. It's got a DAR of about 4. And in the tropion pan tumor 01, this is in the TNBC population. These patients were pretreated. They had there was a response rate of 32% in all patients, but TOPO1 naive patients, 40% duration of response, very long at 16 months. In the topoisomerase inhibitor naive population, median PFS 7 months, and survival in the 13-14 month range. And so we can see that datopotamab, again, is also very active in triple negative breast cancer. And then putting it together with durvalumab, and it was regardless of PD-L1 positive status. And you can see that down the bottom right, that most of the patients, L is low for PD-L1. Most of the patients in this trial were PD-L1 negative, but we see very nice responses and durable responses, putting datopotamab and durvalumab together in the first line setting. So there's trials going on with datopotamab as well. This is the TB-02 trial, and these are patients that are randomized to dato versus investigator choice of chemotherapy. This is the PD-L1 negative population in the first line setting. And we have TB-05. This is the first line setting for PD-L1 positive patients, dato durva versus chemo pembro in the U.S. We're not looking at the dato DXD alone arm. So this is a similar trial as to the ASCENT-04. And then TB-03, the patients, again, residual disease post preoperative therapy for TNBC, residual disease randomized to dato-durva versus dato alone, which is very interesting. Do we really need more checkpoint inhibitor after they've had preoperative checkpoint inhibitor versus capecitabine pembrolizumab? And then preoperative 8 cycles of dato-durva versus KEYNOTE-522. And Heather said this morning that this just enrolled very, very quickly. It beat all expectations for duration of accrual. So we await the results of the TB-04 with regard to PASCR. And then lastly, we have SAC-TMT. So it is sacituzumab, but it's a different payload here. Again, it's got a DAR of 7. It's got a cleavable linker. And we have the data here from the OptiTROP-Breast-01. So this is a phase 3 trial of the SAC-TMT versus chemotherapy. This is in the initial ASCENT-01 population. So TNBC, at least 2 prior lines of therapy, looking at PFS. And what was found here, like in the ASCENT trial, is both PFS and OS are positive. So bringing these TROP2-directed ADCs into the later line setting really improves the natural history. It's interesting, and I didn't mention with datopotamab, we got stomatitis, we have dry eye, we have some nausea, we have some fatigue. So dry eye, stomatitis, and then with the SAC-TMT, we have some myelosuppression, we have some neutropenia, some thrombocytopenia, and we have some stomatitis. About 60% of the patients have, no, 50% have any stomatitis, and we have some rash. So it's interesting. These are all different with regard to their with their toxicities. We saw data on OptiTROP-Breast-05, a single-arm phase 2 trial at ASCO this year in the first-line setting, PD-L1 positive or negative single agent, SAC-TMT, which is given every 2 weeks, as opposed to dato, which is every 3 weeks, and of course, SG is day 1 and day 8, and response rate was the primary endpoint, and the response rate was around 70% as a single agent in the first line setting. So again, another very, very effective agent with a median PFS of 13 months or so. Again, very, very effective. So our summary is that SG and SAC-TMT improve overall survival in pretreated metastatic TNBC. The 3 TROP2 TOPO1 inhibitor ADCs are being evaluated in the first line setting, plus minus IO, as well as in the adjuvant setting for residual disease, post neoadjuvant therapy, and for dato and for SAC-TMT, both as neoadjuvant therapy for TNBC. SG Pembro, significantly more effective than chemo Pembro in prolonging PFS in the first line setting in ASCENT-04. The 3 TROP2 directed ADCs have distinct toxicity. So the real questions we have, we'll bat around some ideas on this, is which ADCs will improve outcome of our early stage patients, which ones will improve survival in the first line setting, and can they be effectively sequenced?
Up next, Dr. Matthew Goetz leads a case discussion with Drs. O'Shaughnessy and Rugo.
All right, case 1, 51-year-old woman diagnosed with metastatic TNBC. Upon further testing, no harmful BRCA mutations were found. The tumor was identified as PD-L1 positive and HER2 IHC 0. She underwent first-line therapy with a taxane plus pembrolizumab and second-line therapy with capecitabine. And she's now experiencing disease progression. Go on to the next slide. So case 1, how would you approach treating this patient? TROP2 targeted antibody drug conjugate such as sacituzumab, eribulin, chemotherapy, enrollment in a clinical trial, or an alternative chemotherapy regimen? Yeah, so I think there's consensus on this. We have data with regard to the role of sacituzumab. obviously leading to a large improvement in PFS as well as overall survival. I know that, you know, when I remember Hope when this the data with trastuzumab deruxtecan came out, and we were in a session with Neil Love, and he asked the question, well, would you actually give TDXD before, you know, this? Obviously, this particular case was HER2-0, but certainly I think in this situation we have very good survival data. So here's the ASCENT trial. This is the practice-changing trial. You can see the design here, patients who had greater than or equal to 2 lines of chemotherapy for triple-negative breast cancer were randomized to sacituzumab govitecan days 1 and 8 every 21-day cycle, as we know, versus treatment of physician's choice, with the primary endpoint being PFS and then the secondary endpoints listed there. So the PFS here, this was a really, in my mind, really important trial. You can see the improvements in PFS from, and it, you know, just shows you how miserable treatment of physician choice was, 1.7 months versus 5.6 months. But then really seeing this robust improvement in overall survival, almost a doubling of survival. Actually, it was hazard ratio of 0.48. So case 2.
So do we want to discuss?
Yeah, do you want to just maybe we can go back and just discuss this a little bit. So I think there's probably a little less discussion on this because it's relatively straightforward, but any comments, Hope and Joyce?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important when you think about ASCENT is that, you know, when ASCENT was going on, we didn't have KEYNOTE-522. We didn't have even PD-L1 testing for giving more aggressive treatment in the first line setting with Pembro. So now we've really moved the ADCs much further up, and I think things are continuously changing. But the fact that we saw 2, you know, ADCs now, sac-TMT not approved, but showing in a smaller trial showing survival benefit, I think really solidifies the role of these drugs. And I think when we see something like this, it does really motivate us to give the drugs much earlier, because we feel like if you had less resistance overall, you could have even longer overall survival and less cumulative toxicity.
Yeah, totally. I think this is our salvage agent for our patients who get the KEYNOTE-522 and recur. This is our go-to drug because they've had so much other exposure. But, you know, you see these kind of survival impact. You hardly ever see this, and you can't wait to get it into the curative setting as soon as possible. So thank goodness we got the ASCENT-05 trial to look forward to.
Yeah, and it is unfortunate that we don't seem to be able to prevent the hair loss. I mean, we're still looking at, you know, cold caps and what we can do to try and optimize preventing hair loss. I mean, it's a big issue for these patients. You know, their hair has just started to grow back if they've had a recurrence. But in the metastatic setting, you know, pretty much guarantees that they're likely to die without hair. And that is a big issue for some patients. I don't know how you guys deal with that.
Yeah, I think in the metastatic setting, it's obviously there's so much focus obviously on you know the what is a very poor prognosis. But I agree with you, Hope. I mean, I think as we begin to move these therapies earlier and earlier, and patients are going to be doing better, and so it's going to become an issue. And so the question is, can we do a better job? I think it's we're going to still continue to use chemotherapy or antibody drug conjugates, but can we do a better job of preventing the hair loss?
So go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's a good point. We're going to get these things up earlier. They're going to be on longer, so it's important for patients. And I don't know, Hope, because, you know, I find that the penguin cold cap, for example, with the very, very, very long duration cooling after you finish the infusion, like up to 5 hours, and it's very, very cold. It's colder than Paxman, you know, for example. I don't know that I have had enough experience. I don't think so. I think people in the metastatic saying they just use the Paxman or the, you know, Dignitana, whatever you have in your infusion suite, they just, because it's easier than bringing in that dry ice, et cetera. But I wonder if a penguin cold cap would be more effective. I don't know if you have any experience on that.
We do, and I think, you know, one there's just one company now. So Paxman bought Dignitana, so now they're combined, which is great because we can try and optimize scalp cooling and also studies, as well as preventing neuropathy with, you know, cold gloves and booties. So lots of positives there. You know, I think the issue with Penguin for patients is We've never shown that duration is correlated well, although we do increase the duration for longer half-life drugs. There's really no data to show that it makes a big difference. And in the late-line metastatic setting, of course, you know, hepatic metabolism plays a huge role. When you last lost your hair plays a huge role. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's the amount of time the drug is hanging around. So going from 3 to 4 hours, to me, is unlikely to make the difference. And there is more risk of thermal injury with penguin caps than with DignaCap or Paxman. So I think it's a big question. I have another question for you, Matt, because you're at Mayo. Do you do pharmacogenomics?
We do. And, you know, what's interesting is actually, many of you know this, but increasingly this data is actually provided to us now by Guardant, so, which is actually really wonderful because, you know, the reality is at some point you're going to be taking a drug that's metabolized and actually having this information as point of care and being able to talk to patients about it is actually fantastic, as opposed to saying, oh, I've got the patient here, I'm going to order this test, and, oh, by the way, it's going to take, you know, 5 days to get the results back. So I think having that as point of care, along with all that other information, I always tell patients, remember, there's two alterations here. There's your somatic alteration, but there's also your germline. You have to be thinking about both. So I think it's great to have that data with the Guardant.
And I hope was just asking, it's on Guardant, you get DPD and you get the UGT1A1, but I don't think we're checking the box. I think it's coming automatically. What do you know? It may be that my nurses are checking the box and I don't know about it.
You know, it's interesting because it just started appearing on mine, so I don't know. Someone must be checking the box somewhere because it's there. So, and it's been very convenient.
Because we had it at UCSF, but I think it's really important. And also, you know, it can be helpful up front because all you need is one out of your 1,000 patients to be DPPD deficient, and then you're really sorry you gave them capecitabine. So it's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also, you know, it's one of those things where if you have, you know, there's a lot of controversy over many years, but the reality is if it's there, you're going to have the conversation with the patient, and you're likely going to reduce the dose. You're not going to say to them, well, let's just see how it goes with high dose. So I think that it's part of shared decision making.
So are you, what do you do, you dose reduce to 7.5 if it's a STAR-28 homozygote, but what about if it's STAR-1, STAR-28?
I don't think we know, and this is where you have to also incorporate information about, you know, let's say a patient had prior chemotherapy and walks into the door with an ANC of 1.3, and so these are, it's part of the entire picture.
And are you using, Joyce, the growth factor, long-acting growth factor after day 8 routinely or only in some patients?
I don't use the long-acting growth factor in general in the metastatic setting on day 8 because it's a relatively short time before that next day 1. They don't get quite that, you know, 13, 14 days I like to see. So I find that that burns marrow and makes the patients increasingly anemic. So I liked the recent trial, what was called the PRIME trial, the PRIME, where they looked at just three days. After day 1 and after day 8. So I usually use mostly a couple doses. I'm not even sure you need 3.
Yes, I agree.
You know, before the day 8, and if they're a little puny on the marrow before the next day 1 as well, you know what I mean? So I'd rather use the smallest amount I can possibly use for patients, and most of them can self-administer, so it's not too much of a problem in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Medicare patients, sometimes the pegfilgrastim, even giving less of a full syringe is worth it. But otherwise, I think that it is, I agree with you 100%. And then let's see, there was one other question there about, they give a bunch of loperamide, which I don't think we do, right? Mm-hmm. We're not. Oh, I know. So are you ever changing the schedule of SG? Do you give it every other week sometimes in some patients?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it does come up where you just cannot deliver it day 1 and 8. I haven't done it so much as of yet, but I certainly wonder about it.
I've had to do it a couple of times. You just, you know, you want the drugs working, but you just need,
the patient's marrow's like getting tired.
Tired, and the marrow's a little puny, so you don't want to lose your response. So that's why I back it off a little bit to every other week.
I've actually seen people's hair grow back on every other week, so it's rare, but, you know, it's like when you dose reduce something else and the hair starts growing back, you know.
Dr. Hope Rugo now takes us through a second case with her colleagues.
Let's go on to case 2. This is a 51-year-old woman who has metastatic TNBC. She doesn't have a germline BRCA mutation, and her tumor is PD-L1 positive, IHC1 plus. She gets first-line therapy with taxane pembro, but I think that might be changing now, even though we don't have approval, particularly in the U.S., not so much in the rest of the world, of course. And she gets CAPE as second line. Let me just stop there. Do you give CAPE as second-line therapy in patients with really bad, like basal-like TNBC?
No, I don't. But sometimes these patients are kind of bone only. You know what I mean?
So if they're a different phenotype,
right,
absolutely.
Right. Sometimes apocrine. They'll have a little bone liver. You know, they have a little bit more, luminal biology. CAPE can buy some time for these patients. It just depends. But if they've got the aggressive basal, they're recurring quickly after 5-2-2. CAPE, unfortunately, is just not going to help them, basically.
Yeah.
And for apocrine disease, though, I've had people stay on for like 2 years,
right, exactly.
You know. So I've had a couple of patients, young patients with bone-only disease, terrible, resistant to everything, metastatic triple-negative disease. So they must be the basal, you know, really basal, but why it's bone-only, I don't know. It's very odd, too. All young.
And some of these patients as well, you know, that are lobular and triple negative can be very difficult to treat as well. And not all of those necessarily are apocrine either.
Yeah,
so,
they're really
yeah.
tough.
Yeah.
Those,
you need NGS on those if you can.
Yeah. And they can have other mutations you can target, which is helpful. So now she has progression. So the question is, how would you treat the patient? SG, TDXD, clinical trial. Or some other chemo. Fenerelbine, also not a favorite of mine in triple negative disease.
And this one was 2+, is that right?
1+.
One plus. Thing.
But third line has gotten CAPE and taxane, pembro. It's interesting, 50-50 SG versus TDXD. What do you think?
I think that because of the survival advantage of the ASCENT trial, that really is a huge improvement. Here we have the data from DB04. There certainly was survival in the right direction, but such small numbers, very difficult, wide confidence intervals. So, you know, the preponderance of data is with the survival with the ASCENT trial. So that would be my my choice. I might try the TXD down the road. I might do that too. For the patients, but I certainly would want to go. These patients have very little time, as we saw, if we don't get on top of this and try to change the natural history, they're going to die quickly. So I would definitely use SG here.
Matt?
I completely agree. I mean, I think you have the survival data. It's very robust. So that would be my choice.
So here's the patient with Matt and Mark Pegram supplied these images. Here you have it. You have the NCCN guidelines, most recent ones from April of 25, with SG category 1 preferred, and FAM trastuzumab deruxtecan is an other recommended regimen. So with the idea that it doesn't have level 1 evidence. And then here's the patient who has really a remarkable shrinkage. It says mixed interval change, some increase, but you know the question is, a lot of times, you know, we think that that may be due to central necrosis and they look a little bit bigger and it's hard. I like to have my diagnostic CTs myself in this case rather than a PET because I find PET can be sometimes hard to interpret. Mm-hmm. How about you guys?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what we do in our practice is PET, but I think you have to be very, very cautious, making sure that you really know what's happening. You certainly don't want to take a patient off a drug too soon, but at the same time, the time is short, and so you don't want to be keeping them on a drug that's not working.
In general, when I have disease that's very easily measurable, that isn't equivocal, then I'll tend to go with CT scans. I'll kind of reserve the PETs for more diagnostic dilemmas, or if they have disease that's more bone, harder to really evaluate disease. But in general, if they have measurable disease, I'm going with CT scans.
We have a number of trials that are looking at sequencing also. So TRADE-DXD is looking at both ER-positive and HR-positive disease. You heard about this earlier, TDXD or Dato-DXT in sequence. And in HER2-low disease, although probably there's going to be some edits to that trial. ENCORE is my colleague Laura Hubbard's registry trial with any approved ADC, but it was really mostly SG and TDXD, I think, is who will enroll. It's both HR-positive and triple-negative. And then the series trial Reshma Matani has with SG after TDXD in 75 patients with hormone receptor positive disease. So we'll learn a lot more about that.
Can I make a comment about it? So if you go back to this, I think one of the things we have to remember, you know, there is a temptation, which is basically you progress in this case on sacituzumab just to continue to give drugs that are brand new. We have to remember, let's just say in a scenario, no, this is not this particular case, but let's remember, let's say the patient had de novo metastatic disease. There are drugs out there, including, you know, we have to remember we have taxanes, right? Taxanes have a substantial benefit. So instead of continuing to give drugs with the same mechanism of action, let's think about and don't forget the drugs that we know have anti-tumor activity, and certainly not forget about taxanes.
No, I totally agree. And Gemcarbo, which can be effective in some of these patients.
Exactly.
Also, eribulin. I've had patients now who had brain mets, and, you know, it's just they're so frustrated with it. You know, they keep popping up with brain mets, so their liver progresses. And so I said they had radiation necrosis and then gave them 10 per kilo of Bev. And, you know, people stayed on for 10 months. Unbelievable. So we have these new bispecifics, which I think are really cool, and with VEGF-A. And immune markers, you know, PD-1, PD-L1, and so maybe we're going to see some benefit with those combinations. But, you know, bevacizumab, our old friend, you know, approved in the rest of the world in triple-negative disease, may actually benefit patients, and we can get it in patients who have brain mets, and you can never, no insurance company knows if it's radiation necrosis or not. So, and we don't either, I will point out. So we think it's, we have no idea. So it's just something to keep in mind, you know, and I really agree with that. And also sometimes, I think, Joyce, you're fond of giving something in between the ADCs.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do them back to back because I agree with what Matt just said. We want to use non-cross-resistant agents. We do have other options for patients. And we get surprises. You really cannot predict this disease. I'm thinking, picking up what Hope just said about a patient who's been on Bev and capecitabine for her lung and brain mets, albeit small volume, we're talking 3 years, and she's perfect. She's perfect. I mean, this disease surprises you. So we have to, you know, keep an open mind and try to change up the therapies, I think.
Totally agree.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. To earn credit for participating in this podcast, please follow the instructions on how to receive credit information in the episode description.